somewhere I read, of the freedom of speech.
Et qui défendait la liberté d'expression.
The moment you limit free speech, it's not free speech.
Somebody will say, oh, freedom of speech, freedom of speech. These are foolish people.
Welcome to Clear and Present Danger, a history of free speech, by Jakub Mshangama.
Clear and Present Danger relies on the generous support of FIRE, the Foundation for Individual Rights in Education, Fridor, and the Politiken Foundation. Episode 1. Who Wishes to Speak? When I decided to do this podcast a couple of years ago, I knew I would have to make a stop in ancient Athens for the trial of Socrates. But I didn't think I'd spend much time in Athens. How relevant could an ancient city-state really be for free speech? And after all, the Athenians had killed Socrates. And their golden age occurred some 2,500 years ago and didn't even last two centuries. But as I started reading more about the Athenian democracy, an amazing new world opened up to me. One in which equal free speech was a fundamental value. Political discussion was radically free compared to anywhere else at the time. Outside politics, I found a culture where comedians and philosophers and ordinary people could speak their minds freely, even when ruffling the feathers of the high and mighty or poking fun at the gods. I found millennia-old arguments in favor of free speech that sounded positively modern. As is true in democracies today, free speech was not universally approved. And the battle over free speech was not limited to philosophical discussions between bearded men in flowing robes. It became a question of life and death. Twice, the Athenian democracy was overthrown by oligarchic regimes. On both occasions, free speech was among the first victims. Many of the central events were driven by larger-than-life characters who were often both brilliant and deeply flawed. Socrates was Athens' most prominent practitioner of uninhibited speech. But were his activities also seditious? And was that why he was executed? Modern democracies share some of the same justifications for free speech with the ancient Athenians. But I found it extremely rare for modern people to connect the dots. Outside the narrow circle of historians of antiquity, the link between ancient and modern free speech had been broken. So the following episode is an attempt to bring to life a pivotal but often forgotten period as we embark on the first stop of what I hope will be a long journey together through the history of free speech. But before we start, if this is your first episode of Clear and Present Danger, feel free to continue listening. But I strongly urge you to listen to the prologue, which sets out the basic premises of why and how I'm doing this podcast. And with that, let's set back the clock to antiquity. Maybe several thousands of years ago, some unknown civilization had developed a culture where free speech was sacred, where rulers and gods could be criticized freely. But if so, history, at least as far as I can tell, left little trace. Many of the great ancient civilizations were ruled by absolutist kings who were thought to hold power by divine right, or even as Egyptian pharaohs, to be divine themselves. That's not exactly fertile ground for free speech. And speaking truth to such power required extreme bravery or a death wish. But then around the 5th century, we get front row seats to a political culture where free speech takes center stage. The Athenian democracy, lasting from around 507 to 322 BC. Famous classicist scholar Mogens Herman Hansen wrote,
"The most treasured of individual rights is freedom of speech, cherished by Democrats, but suppressed by supporters of authoritarian rule. Once more, we find the same ideal in democratic Athens."
Free speech and democracy are so intimately connected in Athens that we have to spend a little time on how democracy worked. But I don't want to get lost in the details, so I'll provide no more than the briefest sketch. If you want a fuller understanding of the Athenian democracy and its development, go to freespeechhistory.com, where I've included some literature that I found very helpful. Thucydides was an Athenian historian from the 5th century who wrote an account of the Peloponnesian War between Athens and their Spartan rivals. The Peloponnesian War is also a crucial source to understanding the Athenian democracy, not least because it recounts a famous funeral oration given by the eminent Athenian statesman Pericles in 430 BC. Pericles says,
"Our constitution is called a democracy because power is in the hands not of a minority, but of the whole people. When it is a question of settling private disputes, everyone is equal before the law."
Mention democracy today, and we think of representative democracy, where elected politicians exercise their political mandate on behalf of voters. Typically, none of us ever get to vote on the laws we have to observe. The Athenians would be horrified. The democracy praised by Pericles was a direct democracy, where the citizens themselves proposed, debated, and voted for the laws that governed them. Hence, the importance of free speech, as we'll see in a bit. The road towards democracy was paved in 510 BC, when the last Athenian king was expelled. In this power vacuum, a man called Cleisthenes won out. In 507, Cleisthenes instituted democratic reforms. And during the next century, democracy grew ever more egalitarian. The three main political institutions, the assembly, council, and people's courts, were all given more powers at the expense of oligarchic institutions. Although full democratic participation was restricted to free-born Athenian males, women, slaves, and foreigners were excluded. The centerpiece of Athenian democracy was the popular assembly called the Ecclesia. The assembly debated and adopted laws, and in 390, the people were paid for participating in the assembly, allowing the poor an equal voice. The proceedings of the assembly were nothing like a modern parliament. Often 6,000 citizens or more would be present. Voting was done by a show of hands, and the majority was then estimated by magistrates. Now imagine you have to vote on whether to go to war or not. For politicians today, it would be a question of whether to send in the troops, meaning someone else. But in Athens, the troops were you. You were the one who might have to face a Spartan phalanx in open battle, knowing full well that while you'd been debating in the marketplace, the Spartans had been perfecting the art of killing on a strict diet of black soup and constant drills. So having to distinguish between 2,900 hands raised in favor of going to war and 3,100 against was a pretty big call to make. The Athenians had no word for what we call a politician. They referred to them as rhetores or orators. In practice, these were the men who dominated the proceedings of the assembly, framing the arguments for or against the adoption of laws. They could also help with trial speeches in the courts. But the skills of an orator did not come cheaply. Teachers journeyed from city to city, offering their services. The average wage of a worker was probably around 1 drachma a day, corresponding to maybe 40 or 50 US dollars. But the best teachers would charge up to 1,000 drachmas or more. So only a select few had the means to get Ivy League training and disproportionate political and legal influence. The Council of 500 consisted of 50 members of each of Athens' 10 tribes. Among other things, the council prepared laws to be adopted by the assembly. Magistrates on the council were drawn by lot to guard against corruption and faction based on the principle of governing and being governed in turn. And finally, we have the People's Court. Its role can be compared to a modern Supreme Court. It could rule on decisions of the council and the interpretation of laws passed by the assembly. But unlike modern courts, there were no professional judges. Instead, cases were decided by up to 1,500 jurors drawn by lot. And both civil and criminal cases were brought, argued, and decided by citizens. So why was free speech so important? The Athenians had two overlapping but separate concepts of free speech. The first is called isagoria, which may be translated as equality of speech. The second concept is paresia, which may be translated as frank or uninhibited speech. So isagoria, equality of speech, and paresia, frank speech. Remember that. Central to both isagoria and paresia is what scholar Arlene Saxenhaus calls the egalitarian foundations and participatory principles of the democratic regime of the Athenians. So free speech was an inherent part of the political system and culture, not an individual human right protecting you against the state. This is difficult for us to understand, for liberal democracies are built on the premise that citizens have rights that even the largest majority cannot violate. But the Athenians literally constituted their own government, and the state did not exist as a separate entity from the people. Isagoria, equality of speech, was exercised in the assembly. Each session was opened by an official with the statement, "Who wishes to speak?" Socrates, certainly no fan of democracy, described the assembly as a place where both the, quote, rich, poor, noble, and lowborn could deliberate. There was no divine pharaoh or despotic king whose arbitrary whims dictated the limits of speech. The Athenians were clearly proud of their political system. The ancient Greek historian Herodotus argued that when the Athenians were living under tyranny, they were unremarkable. But with equality of speech, they became the most powerful of the Greeks. Pericles also joined in the praise of his own country.
"We Athenians take our decisions on policy or submit them to proper discussions. The worst thing is to rush into action before the consequences have been properly debated."
The Athenian commitment to free speech also set them apart from their Spartan enemies. The great orator Demosthenes, whom we'll talk more about later, made an observation as relevant for free speech today as it was 2,300 years ago. He contrasts democratic Athens with oligarchic Sparta. In Athens, you're free to praise the Spartan constitution, but in Sparta, only the Spartan constitution can be praised. The ability to freely criticize one's own political system is still the litmus test of democracies today. You only have to look at present-day Turkey or Russia to see that the Athenians were far ahead of their time in liberality. It's important not to paint too rosy a picture of free speech in Athens. There were limits. Introducing unconstitutional laws was forbidden by what the Athenians called graphe paranomon. So, no, you couldn't just promise free meals to everyone and then introduce a law abolishing democracy and making yourself king. And while Isagoria ensured equality of speech in the assembly, it didn't bar the assembly from passing laws limiting what could be said outside the assembly. Kakegoria, or what we'd call defamation, was also prohibited. Impiety, or asebaya, was another serious offense, punishable by death. The Eulician mysteries were secret religious rites. Profaning the mysteries or exposing them to the uninitiated was an egregious act of impiety. But it is very uncertain how often this law was used against impious speech and thought. One possible example of impiety sanctioned by law is the philosopher Anaxagoras, who may have been sentenced to death, but never executed, around 450 for claiming that the sun was a flaming stone. The trial of Socrates for impiety also showed that the tolerance of the Athenians was not unlimited. But impiety may not have been the main concern of Socrates' accusers, as we'll explore shortly. What we do know is that the law against impiety was nowhere near as sweeping or harsh as the draconian laws against blasphemy and heresy that would dominate Europe for more than a millennium after Christianity became the state religion of the Roman Empire. In practice, some Athenians had better access to speak than others. Imagine having to debate laws in a public assembly of 6,000. If each speaker was limited to 5 minutes, it would still have taken 500 hours to decide on whether to build that new road or not. So the orators dominated. But the silent majority was not exactly silent. The assembly could be an unforgiving place. Orators were often heckled through jeers and booing, or thorubos. Think of the proceedings in the British House of Commons, where members loudly proclaim their displeasure or approval when an MP takes the floor. Then imagine adding 5,350 opinionated and agitated Athenian men, and you get an idea of how intimidating a place the assembly could be. And heckling also took place in the courts. Say you were accused of a crime carrying the death penalty. Then imagine that while defending yourself in order to save your life, you didn't have a professional lawyer, you get aggressively heckled by the very jury that decides whether your next drink is a glass of wine to calm the nerves after acquittal or a nice cup of lethal hemlock. As a practice, parrhesia, or frank speech, had a much wider application than isagoria, because it wasn't limited to the political sphere of the assembly. It was parrhesia that allowed the free discussion of politics in the agora, the marketplace where citizens mingled freely, in drama such as the old comedies, where neither the gods nor the high and mighty citizens were spared. There was no public institution of censorship or inquisition to ensure conformity in writing, science, and public discourse. Even foreigners, and sometimes slaves, would exercise free speech. And parrhesia also allowed for a rich intellectual life in Athens. The two rock stars of Western philosophy, Plato and Aristotle, both set up shop in Athens. Plato was hostile towards democracy and advocated what some have called a totalitarian state. Aristotle had mixed feelings about democracy and warned lawmakers against indecency of speech.
For the light utterance of shameful words leads soon to shameful actions.
Oh, and don't get Aristotle started on that instrument of cultural mass destruction, the flute. But both Aristotle and Plato were allowed to write, teach, and set up academies in Athens. Here they could promote alternative constitutions to the one that ensured their right to philosophize freely. An Athenian free thought also saw great advancements in science and medicine that might have been impossible under a system of strict political or religious censorship. This egalitarian practice of free speech was a radical difference from later European history. As we shall see, time and again, up to and including much of the Enlightenment, censorship
and draconian punishments were justified by an existential dread of how the uneducated commoner, the unwashed and unruly mob, would react to new ideas challenging political or religious orthodoxy. One of the advantages that the Athenians saw in free speech, recent deliberation of democratic decisions, still serves as an important justification for free speech in modern democracies. In fact, the link between isogoria and modern democracy comes across in our language. In Danish, Norwegian, and German, a political vote in democratic elections is called stemme or stimme, which literally means voice, conveying the idea that democracy allows everyone a say in the governance of their affairs. Okay, so we've talked about the Athenian democracy and the concepts of isogoria and parrhesia. But how did it work in practice? Remember Pericles bragging that the Athenians always considered their actions through debate, so they didn't screw up and make bad decisions? Well, that might have been the ideal. During the Peloponnesian War, the city of Mytilene revolted against their Athenian allies. So the Athenians sent a ship with orders to kill all the men and enslave the women and children. But the next day, many Athenians got cold feet. So they assembled to debate whether it really was such a good idea to commit genocide. Humor me here, as I may be stretching my imagination beyond breaking point. But think back to 2002 and the intense drama when the United States Congress voted on a resolution about the Iraq War. Now imagine Congress voting not just on whether to depose Saddam Hussein, but whether to kill all adult Iraqi males and enslave their families. I know, pretty far-fetched. But this was the type of decision that the Athenians were making, and the intensity must have been extreme. Opinion was sharply divided. Cleon, an aggressive imperialist hawk, pressed the case for showing no mercy, and Diodotus, a moderate politician, argued for restraint. Cleon's speech was an attack on the utility of democracy and isogoria. Thucydides has Cleon saying,
"I have often before now been convinced that a democracy is incapable of empire, and never more so than by your present change of mind in the matter of Mytilene. Fears or plots being unknown to you in your daily relations with each other, you feel just the same with regard to your allies, and never reflect that the mistakes into which you may be led by listening to their appeals or by giving way to your own compassion are full of danger to yourselves."
Cleon sees democratic debate as prone to abuse by sophistry. You can't run an empire on mercy inspired by seductive rhetoric. You've got to be ruthless. And then he added populism to his warmongering. He suggested that his opponents may be bribed to try to delude us by elaborate sophisms. But Diodotus was no Gandhi either. He didn't oppose genocide on humanitarian principles. But on foreign policy, he appealed to the Periclean values of recent deliberation.
"The two things most opposed to good counsel are haste and passion. Haste usually goes hand in hand with folly, passion with coarseness and narrowness of mind."
Diodotus then attacked Cleon's attempt to smear opponents of genocide. Without an honest debate on the merits, fear and silence would rule.
"The good citizen ought to triumph not by frightening his opponents, but by beating them fairly in argument."
Diodotus not only defended democratic debate, he also warned that demagoguery undermined these ideals. That's an extremely relevant lesson, even today. Diodotus' arguments carried the day, and the citizens of Mytilene were spared. outside politics, drama, especially old comedy, but also tragedy, shows just how free the Athenians were when it came to criticizing their own institutions, culture, and elite. We don't have the time to explore this fascinating subject in any detail, but a writer of comedy like Aristophanes pulled no punches. He mercilessly trolled Socrates, who was portrayed as a buffoon, and Cleon, our hawkish politician, was turned into a corrupt slave. Even gods like Dionysus were fair game. Aristophanes also gave a voice to women, who lived under a form of gender apartheid, hidden from Athenian public life. Silence is a woman's glory, in the words of Aristotle. But in the comedy Lysistrata, women, sick and tired of the war between Athens and Sparta, conspire to refuse their husbands sex until the end hostilities. In fact, the artistic freedom available to Aristophanes in the 5th century BC surpassed that enjoyed by Americans and Greeks in periods of the 19th and 20th century. From 1873 until 1930, Lysistrata was banned from import and distribution in the US. It was also banned during the Greek military dictatorship from 1967 to 74. In tragedy, Euripides often praised Parrhasia in his plays. When John Milton wrote Areopagitica, his famous defense of unlicensed publishing in 1644, it was prefaced by a quote from Euripides.
"This is true liberty when freeborn men, having to advise the public, may speak free."
Ironically, the seductive rhetoric in the assembly would also be a decisive factor in the decay of Athens' power. In 415, the assembly voted to launch the disastrous Sicilian expedition against Syracuse, where much of the Athenian army and navy perished. It was the hero-cum-villain Alcibiades who managed to persuade the assembly. Alcibiades was an Athenian celebrity, blessed with the looks and larger-than-life personality of a rock star. But he was also extremely opportunistic. The only person who could reason with him was Socrates, whom Alcibiades admired deeply. Alcibiades gave a rousing speech in the assembly in favor of conquering Syracuse. Thucydides writes about its effect.
"All alike fell in love with the enterprise. With this enthusiasm of the majority, the few that liked it not, feared to appear unpatriotic by holding up their hands against it, and so kept quiet."
Athens' imperial dreams were shipwrecked in Syracuse. But democracy and free speech were also in lethal danger. The Athenians panicked, and many lost faith in democracy, and started blaming those that had argued in favor of invasion. Now, if you were an aristocrat who resented sharing power with the poor, this was the perfect time to snuff out democracy and establish rule by the best and wisest, not to mention the wealthiest. And so in 411, a group of oligarchs called the 400 instigated a coup. Implicated in the scheming was none other than Alcibiades. He had fallen dramatically from grace after being convicted of profaning the Eleusinian mysteries and had defected to Sparta of all places, where he plotted against Athens. To pave way for the 400, key Democrats were assassinated. Next, the assembly and council were intimidated into serving as the mouthpiece of the schemers. Thucydides writes that the conspirators controlled everything that was said and debated.
"Fear and the sight of the numbers of the conspirators closed the mouths of the rest. Or if any ventured to rise in opposition, he was presently put to death in some convenient way. The people remained motionless, being so thoroughly cowed that men thought themselves lucky to escape violence, even when they held their tongues."
So intimidated were the Athenians that the assembly even voted unanimously to abolish most of its own powers and adopt a new oligarchic constitution. But the democratic spirit was still strong with the Athenians, and democracy was reinstated after only 3 months. It's easy to condemn the Athenians as spineless and fickle, but how would we react today in a similar situation? Imagine if America had been completely defeated in the Korean War, losing hundreds of thousands of troops and most of its air force and navy. The media would report that the Soviets prepared for an invasion of the defenseless homeland, and European allies defected to the communist side in droves. Would Americans have stayed true to democracy, or been so angry and scared that they replaced the Republic with a new regime, promising renewed greatness at the cost of free speech? After the democratic recovery, it was time to vindicate Herodotus and show that democracy always wins. Well, almost. Under the command of, wait for it, Alcibiades, the Athenians did manage a recovery. But then military disasters struck again. In 405, the Athenians finally lost the Peloponnesian War against Sparta. In 404, the Spartans abolished democracy and instituted the rule of the 30 tyrants, an oligarchic regime which soon developed into a bloody dictatorship. The leader of the most extreme element of the 30 tyrants was Critias, who, like Alcibiades, had been close to Socrates. Think of Critias as a Robespierre-like tyrant and Quisling-like traitor rolled into one. If your name was not on a list of citizens controlled entirely by the 30, you could be summarily executed at any time. As many as 1,500 Athenian citizens were killed in the anti-democratic purge. Others were banished or fled. Some conspirators protested the methods of the 30 as too extreme. But Critias dismissed them as bleeding-heart oligarchs.
If anyone among you thinks that too many people are being put to death, let him consider that where governments change, these things have to happen. It is inevitable that those who are changing the government here to an oligarchy should have most numerous enemies, because the common folk have been bred and reared in a condition of freedom for the longest time.
Critias finished with this icy warning.
And if we find anyone opposed to the oligarchy, we put him out of the way.
But amazingly, democracy once again prevailed. And even more amazingly, an amnesty was put in place, ensuring a peaceful transfer of power. Though Critias was killed in battle. I think it's very tempting to look at these two coups as history's first confirmation of the old saying that free speech is the first victim of tyranny. Or in the words of Benjamin Franklin 1900 years later,
whoever would overthrow the liberty of a nation must begin by subduing the freeness of speech.
Because that's literally what happened. It was under democracy that equal and uninhibited speech flourished. As soon as democracy was subverted, so too was free and equal speech. But the coups of the 400 and the 30 made the Athenians jealous of their democracy. And they are very likely crucial to understanding why the free speech-loving Athenians came to execute their most prolific practitioner of parrhesia. If you were an Athenian citizen in the second half of the 5th century and went to the Agora, chances are you'd run into a man with a peculiar swagger in his walk, bulging eyes, a flat and upwards turned nose, and large, meaty lips. Always barefoot and unwashed. He never changed his clothes, despite using them as a blanket during the night. This shabby-looking figure was the man many consider the founder of Western philosophy, Socrates. Quite an achievement for a man who never wrote a sentence. So we have to rely on other sources, including his students Xenophon and Plato. But the picture we get is inconsistent. And for ages, scholars and writers have tried to solve the Socratic problem of who he really was. John Stuart Mill called Socrates the most virtuous man of his age. Author I.F. Stone, on the other hand, paints a picture of Socrates as an almost fanatical anti-democrat, poisoning the minds of the Athenian elite. That's a debate I'll avoid. For our purposes, the burning question is, why did the Athenians execute Socrates in 399 at the ripe age of 70, when he had been speaking in public for decades? Unfortunately, we won't be able to settle the debate, but we can make an educated guess, though again, opinion is divided on this issue. In 399, a man called Meletus indicted Socrates by a graphe asebias, a public action for impiety. The indictment read,
"Socrates is guilty of not acknowledging the gods acknowledged by the state and of introducing other new divinities. Furthermore, he is guilty of corrupting the young. Penalty proposed, capital punishment."
What had Socrates done? Socrates is famous for his dialectic method. It's basically a Q&A on a topic such as the meaning of virtue or justice. Socrates would subject his opponent to a humiliating intellectual striptease by tricking him down logical dead ends until even the most prominent of Athenians were forced to admit their own ignorance. Socrates' opponents would start sweating or break down in tears when stripped naked and slowly roasted. In Plato's Symposium, even Alcibiades admits that he has to pluck his ears and run away from Socrates, the only man who has ever made him feel ashamed. And remember, this is the guy who not only persuaded the Athenians to embark on the Sicilian expedition, but also convinced them to let him return as a general after his treasonous defection to Sparta. If we are to believe Plato, and there are strong reasons to be cautious, as Plato was a devoted pupil of Socrates, Socrates knew that his insistence on pursuing truth and justice, as he saw it, rubbed many powerful Athenians the wrong way. He even prophesied his own fate. In Plato's Gorgias, written almost 20 years after the death of Socrates, he admits that he could be dragged into court by
wicked men, and it wouldn't be at all strange if I were to be put to death.
Why might Socrates be put to death?
Because the speeches I make do not aim at gratification, but at what's best instead of what's most pleasant.
Another important factor was that Socrates often claimed his inner voice, his daimonion, guided his action. This supported the claim that Socrates proselytized his own secretive religion, undermining the religious values of the democratic city-state. A step too far for the Athenians, for whom religion and politics were not strictly separate spheres. New gods could be introduced, but this required communal acceptance to ensure that new deities and their followers contributed and didn't endanger the basic values. Plato's apology seeks to downplay the impiety charge by having Socrates tricking Meletus into accusing him of outright atheism, an accusation easily refuted by Socrates. And if so, the whole trial must be tainted, right? But this is likely Plato misleading his readers. To make matters worse, in 415, five of Socrates' friends, including Alcibiades, were convicted of profaning the Eleusinian mysteries and mutilating sacred religious statues. As such, the impiety charge might have had merit in itself, as argued by Cambridge professor Paul Cartledge. But Mogens Herman Hansen also makes the case that the trial was likely politically motivated, that Socrates was literally found guilty by association for having developed close relations with Critias, Alcibiades, and a number of other prominent oligarchs that had been actively opposed to democracy. Legally, Socrates could not be convicted for what had happened prior to 403 due to the amnesty. But the jury could be swayed by arguments that were not formally relevant from a legal point of view, and such arguments were perfectly admissible in court. So an indictment for impiety could de facto be expanded into a case of what we would call sedition. According to Xenophon, Socrates' relationship with the greedy and violent Critias and the licentious and insolent Alcibiades was in fact brought up by his accusers during the trial. And so was Socrates' criticism of how magistrates were chosen by lot rather than expertise, which smacked a little too much of oligarchy to the Athenians. Xenophon quotes Socrates' accuser as saying,
"In the young, such arguments stir up contempt of the constitution and make them violent."
And importantly, in the 4th century, a prominent orator stated that
Socrates the Sophist was executed because he was shown to have been the teacher of Critias, one of the 30 who overthrew the democracy.
Why would he say so if this wasn't the accepted understanding at the time? What we do know is that Socrates did not help his own case. In fact, his defense, as recounted in Plato's Apology, is the kind of performance that would make any savvy criminal defense lawyer bang his head against the courtroom desk. Remember, there's no jury instruction by a professional judge. Sure, the jurors are sworn to follow the law, but nothing prevents them from sticking it to somebody if they think he might be innocent under the law, but guilty of being a scumbag. A defense attorney would instruct the defendant to be humble and appeal to the sympathy of the jury. Socrates chose another strategy. He pursued truth even at the expense of death and wouldn't denigrate his principles by pandering to the jury. This quote is pretty gutsy when your guilt is about to be determined by 501 of your fellow citizens.
"And this is the point in which, as I think, I am superior to men in general, and in which I might perhaps fancy myself wiser than other men, that whereas I know but little of the world below, I do not suppose that I know."
Quite a few of the jurors might have asked themselves, "Hold on a minute, did this smelly old guy, this teacher of a treasonous, murderous dictator, just call me an ignorant fool?" And to make matters worse, Socrates also told the story of how one of his disciples asked the Delphic oracle about him, and how
"Apollo answered that no man was more free than I, or more just, or more prudent."
No extra small leather glove will sway the jury after that. In Socrates' defense, it should be said that he had fought bravely for Athens during the Peloponnesian War, that he had refused to participate in an extrajudicial execution during the rule of the 30 tyrants, and that the 30 had specifically prohibited Socrates from philosophizing in public. This was arguably proof that he was neither unpatriotic nor an anti-democratic partisan. But it was not enough to save him from being found guilty. When convicted, the jurors had to decide on the penalty, with defendant and accusers each proposing an option. Again, according to Xenophon, Socrates basically mocked the jurors by proposing that his punishment should consist of being provided with free meals at the town hall. Not impressed with Socrates' hubris, more jurors voted for the death penalty than voted for his guilt. Socrates left the trial with these famous last words:
"The hour of departure has arrived, and we go our ways. I to die, and you to live. Which is better, God only knows."
And thereby, the first martyr for free speech was born. Though that too is debatable, because at no point does Socrates offer a principled defense of the Athenian values of free speech, He doesn't seem to question the justice of laws punishing someone for their speech, only their specific application to him. So how should we judge the Athenians? I'm most inclined to follow Mogens Herman Hansen's suggestion that the trial was basically politically motivated, that the Athenians had become militant Democrats, afraid that the corrosive influence of Socrates' missionary activity might result in a new oligarchic coup toppling the democracy. If so, we have numerous much later instances that fit the same pattern in the most enlightened states of their time. Take the Sedition Act of 1798, introduced by the young American Republic when war with France seemed imminent, but abused to silence critics of President Adams. Or the French revolutionaries who started chopping off heads for wrong opinions during the Terror. That might help explain, even if it doesn't justify, why the Athenian democracy executed Socrates. Socrates' trial is also a good showcase of the shortcomings of the Athenian model, and why free speech needs the protection of fundamental rights and independent courts to protect free thinkers and minorities against revanchist majorities. If Socrates was the greatest philosopher of classical antiquity, Demosthenes may well have been its finest orator. Demosthenes is often hailed as the last defender of Athenian democracy and liberty against the greedy imperial ambitions of Philip II of Macedon, the father of a certain Alexander the Great. The combination of rhetorical genius and dogged defense of liberty and patriotism made Demosthenes a model for both Cicero in his fight for the dying republic and Churchill's efforts to warn against the threat of Hitler. Ultimately, Demosthenes' attempt to ensure Athenian independence would be in vain, as Philip crushed the Greeks at the Battle of Chaeronea in 338 BC, and the Macedons put down a new revolt in 322. That Demosthenes should be remembered as the finest orator to grace history more than 2,000 years after his death is a bit of a miracle, really. Demosthenes was born in 384 as a sickly child who developed serious speech impediments. As a youth, he became obsessed with oratory. He studied endlessly to improve his public speaking. But his speech impediment and boring delivery made him a laughingstock in the assembly. So according to the Greek biographer Plutarch, writing in the 2nd century AD, Demosthenes went to extremes. He started speaking with pebbles in his mouth to overcome his lisp, and practiced speaking while climbing hills to overcome his shortness of breath. Plutarch even claims that Demosthenes built a cave beneath his house, where he would spend months practicing how to deliver speeches. And that's not all. In order to enforce self-discipline, he would shave off all the hair on one side of his head so that he would be mocked if he should leave the cave. Having mastered the art of oratory, Demosthenes was asked about the three most important elements of public speaking. His answer? Delivery, delivery, delivery. And delivery could. In speech after speech, he would remind the Athenians of their proud inheritance of freedom, democracy, and autonomy. Demosthenes often praised free speech. According to one historian, Demosthenes' surviving speeches include more references to parrhesia, 26, than any other figure from the Athenian democracy. You could even argue that several of John Stuart Mill's justifications for free speech in On a Liberty from 1859 were articulated by Demosthenes more than 2,000 years before Mill was even born. In Exordia, Demosthenes admonishes hecklers in the assembly.
It is your duty, however, when deliberating on matters of supreme importance and of general concern, to be willing to listen to all your counselors. It would be shameful, men of Athens, to create an uproar now, when a number of speakers wish to propose some measure, but later to enjoy hearing these same men denouncing what has been done.
For Demosthenes, rational debate in the assembly was necessary to reach the best possible decision. And by allowing both sides an argument, free speech also ensures that decision-makers, i.e. the people, assume responsibility for their actions and can't just turn around and blame everyone else. Cue the Sicilian expedition. But you could also argue that Demosthenes warns against confirmation bias. Seek out both sides of an argument. That insight is also relevant today, where social media, fueled by algorithms, risk creating echo chambers, filtering information to suit our biases, rather than ensuring pluralism. Historical analogies are always imperfect, but I think you could argue that Demosthenes not only articulated Millian arguments before Mill, he also articulated Miltonian arguments before John Milton. Central to Milton's attack on censorship is the idea that free speech furthers truth. In a funeral oration, Demosthenes contrasted democracies with oligarchies. Oligarchies produce fear. Democracies, on the other hand,
have many noble and just qualities. In particular, it is impossible to deter freedom of speech from exposing the truth.
In the era of social media, we might be more skeptical of whether free speech always exposes the truth. But you can still hear the echoes of Demosthenes in both Milton and Mill. Okay, so until now, I've painted a picture of Demosthenes as this almost saintly figure. That's not the whole story. Demosthenes could also be a self-serving and unprincipled politician, prone to exaggeration and hyperbole. He wrote trial speeches of questionable integrity, including outrageous character assassinations that he thought would sway the jury. In the assembly, he would mix brilliant rhetoric with low blows and demonization. When his opponents went low, Demosthenes would not necessarily go high. This is how he describes Philip of Macedon in one of his Philippics, as his speeches against Philip are called.
He is not only no Greek, nor related to the Greeks, but not even a barbarian from any place that can be named with honor, but a pestilent knave from Macedonia, whence it was never yet possible to buy a decent slave.
Today, we would call such rhetoric bigoted. In fact, there are countries in Europe today where those words might lead to a conviction for hate speech. Demosthenes' archenemy was another great orator called Aeschines, who favored appeasement of Philip. The two squared off in one of antiquity's greatest heavyweight championship rhetorical battles, when Aeschines took one of Demosthenes' supporters to court. But no one was in doubt that the real defendant was Demosthenes. Demosthenes replied with his trial speech on the crown from 330 BC, which many classicists regard as the best speech in the history of mankind. And it does include a lot of highlights. I particularly like what must be the ultimate mic drop of classical antiquity. To set the stage, Demosthenes' character and parentage has been viciously attacked by Aeschines. So Demosthenes replies by comparing the merits of the two, trolling Aeschines with his low birth and education, the questionable occupation of his parents, and his unsuccessful career as an actor. The speech steadily builds up momentum and culminates in this unforgettable passage.
You taught school. I was a student. You conducted initiation rites. I was initiated. You served as a public scribe. I attended the assembly. You played bit parts on stage. I sat in the audience. You were hissed off stage. I was hissing. All your policies helped the enemy. Mine helped our country.
Aeschines had no snappy comeback to Demosthenes' rhetorical uppercut. He lost the case and had to quit Athens. But Demosthenes' life also ended tragically. He was convicted of bribery and left Athens, only to be allowed back. But when the Greeks lost the Lamian War in 322, Demosthenes committed suicide by taking poison rather than being captured by the Macedonians. Demosthenes' death coincides with the end of classical Greece, as Athens and the other city-states lost their independence for good. But important parts of their heritage and culture would live on and inspire new golden ages for philosophy and science. Central Asians, Arabs, and later Western Europeans came to accept Aristotle's claim that all men by nature desire to know. And after some 2,000 years of being viewed with suspicion and hostility, the combination of democracy and free speech became the only game in town in the West, and then gained global reach that has only ground to a halt very recently. But the first to benefit from the rich inheritance of Greece and the culture, philosophy, and art that flourished in the mild conditions of Isagoria and Parisia was an aggressively expanding Latin city-state that would become the imperial overlord of the Hellenes, Rome. So make sure to follow the next episode and find out if the speeches of Cicero and Cato can keep free speech alive in a republic boasting the ego of Julius Caesar. And what's up with Caesar's young nephew Octavian? Or is it Augustus? Thank you so much for listening. Today's episode was edited by Søren Stahøj, and Matthias Meyer assisted with valuable research. As always, please check out freespeechhistory.com for more details and sources about the events covered in this episode. Please do contact me on Facebook, Twitter, or email with your parousia, corrections, suggestions for improvements, or even praise.